this as true. We have Ms. Johnson.
Yes. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Nastasia Johnson on behalf of Plaintiff Theodis Nelms, Jr. Your Honors, there are two main reasons why the ALJ's decision that found Mr. Nelms not disabled was improper in this case. First, the ALJ failed to fully and fairly develop the record. As this Court held in Thompson v. Shalala, ALJs have a general duty to develop a full and fair record. However, when a claimant proceeds to hearing pro se, the ALJ's duty becomes heightened, and they must scrupulously and conscientiously probe into all relevant facts. As this Court held in Binion v. Shalala, an ALJ meets that burden when they probe into all relevant disabilities and all relevant evidence. In this case, Mr. Nelms attended his hearing pro se, heightening the ALJ's duty. However, the ALJ failed to meet the burden under Binion because he failed to analyze and obtain over 100 pages of medical evidence that documented Mr. Nelms' continuing cardiac impairments and documented for the first time his orthopedic conditions. This additional medical evidence was a significant omission that prejudiced Mr. Nelms' disability claim. Specifically, the ALJ found that Mr. Nelms' orthopedic conditions were absent or not significant. However, between the time period of 2003 until 2005, those 100 additional pages of medical evidence, which is contained in the separate appendix, show that Mr. Nelms underwent x-rays. They demonstrated that he had degenerative changes of the thoracic spine, that he had disc bulging at L2 to L3, diffuse disc bulging from L4 to L5, and disc degeneration from L5 to S1. In addition, he was prescribed Vicodin, Percocet, and methadone, and it was noted that in 2005, his primary care physician doubled his methadone dosage to 10 milligrams because of poor pain management.
Also, during that gap period, is there any evidence in the record of a deterioration either in the pulmonary or the cardiac function?
Yes, Your Honor. In the additional 100 pages you're talking about?
That's right.
Okay. What the ALJ did know was that Mr. Nelms had a heart infection and that he underwent a mitral valve replacement surgery. What the ALJ believed was that that the surgery went beautifully well and that he underwent cardiac rehabilitation without incident. However, the additional medical records did show that in 2004 he underwent an echocardiogram and that his left ventricle was borderline hypertrophic. Additionally, he continually complained of shortness of breath due to his heart condition, and that it was found he had a loss of normal ventricular ejection fraction.
But are those are phenomena that were observed, but do they necessarily show a deterioration from the earlier period?
Your Honor, I can't pretend to know what the severity of the medical evidence actually shows. However, the orthopedic conditions that were documented, as well as the cardiac conditions that were documented in that 100 pages, shows that there was evidence out there that the ALJ failed to consider.
And yet in April of 2005, his attending internist did see him, and in a note in the record, basically says that he's in stable condition.
Are you talking about Dr. Bosovich's?
That's right.
Okay. Dr. Bosovich wrote in a four-line sentence, it was contained in the standard administration paperwork, which doctors don't normally write on. However, Dr. Bosovich was also the doctor who prescribed him methadone in 2005 and doubled that methadone dosage in 2005 because of poor pain management. Dr. Bosovich also noted that Mr. Nelms had low back pain, and he noted that his cardiac condition was stable, but that does not mean it was better. It just means that it wasn't getting better, it wasn't getting worse. It was just kind of neutral.
Well, that's my point. His attending internist in April of 2005 seems to say that the basic machinery of the body is not getting any worse.
Your Honor, Dr. Bosovich did say that. However, it is contrary to what the 100 pages of additional medical evidence stated.
Is there anything in the record that would indicates whether his attending internist, Dr. Bakovich, did or did not have access to that material?
There's nothing in the record to indicate that. He was his treating physician, but he was also seeing at the same clinic, Dr. Libischik's, and she was the one that also dealt with his orthopedic conditions. It's unknown why Dr. Bosovich wrote that four-line sentence. However, that four-line sentence in the record somehow does not bridge the gap between the last record that the ALJ had before him, which was from the summer of 2003, until the date of Mr. Nelms' hearing, which was June 14, 2005.
Can we go back to an earlier, or rather forward to the hearing from the period I've been talking about? The advice about counsel that was given to your client, was that, in your view, correct advice?
I'm sorry, I don't think I understand your question.
The advice that was given to your client about his right to have counsel present, was the ALJ correct in the advice that he gave?
Your Honor, we're not contesting that the waiver of attorney statements was wrong, but what we are saying is that the statements he made, we believe it lulled Mr. Nelms, a pro se claimant, to reasonably believe that the record would be complete before the ALJ made its...
Well, then you're saying that the advice wasn't correct. It lulled your client into a belief that he was going to be taken care of.
Yes, Your Honor. We're not contesting that, but we do believe that it did lull him into believing that, as well as the fact that Mr. Nelms did testify at his hearing that he had low back pain, leg pain daily, that he was prescribed methadone, and that he was sent to a back specialist for a possible pinched nerve. He also informed the administration in the standard Social Security Administration paperwork that he had updated treatment. He specifically named doctors by name. He named new hospitals and new medications, including that methadone, which was never prescribed before.
Am I correct that the ALJ said that orthopedic signs were absent?
Correct. And contrary to the ALJ's assessment, the orthopedic conditions are objectively verified and at least require remand to go back for the ALJ to assess again. This could greatly affect Mr. Nelms' case, as the ALJ found that he could perform light work, which requires standing and walking for 6 hours out of an 8-hour day. If the ALJ found, based on this additional medical evidence, that he would be limited to sedentary work, he would be found disabled based on Medical Vocational Guideline Rule 201.12.
Ms. Johnson, one last question, if I may. Your client smoking, to what degree did that contribute to his difficulty with environmental situations, and what are the implications with respect to his rights for benefits?
Your Honor, there is no indication in the record or no doctor opined that smoking exacerbated his asthma. This would be something that the ALJ could consider upon remand, but the ALJ never included any limitations regarding Mr. Nelms' asthma in his residual functional capacity assessment. He also ignored Dr. Collier, Social Security's own doctor, who opined that Mr. Nelms should avoid concentrated exposure to fumes, odors, dust, gases, and poor ventilation. This environmental restriction falls between very little and excessive, as this court held in Warmoth v. Bowen. When an environmental restriction falls between that range, an ALJ should consult with the vocational expert to determine whether the occupational bases would be eroded. In this case, the ALJ made an independent determination without consulting any vocational source, so it's unknown whether or not he could actually perform the full range of light work and the lower end of medium exertional work as the ALJ held. I see that I'm in my rebuttal time. If Your Honors have no further questions, I will yield the podium.
Ms. Bisenthal.
May it please the Court, Christine Bautista on behalf of the Commissioner of Social Security. The ALJ satisfied his heightened duty to develop the record in this case, both respect...
Sorry, could you just tell us your name again?
Christine Bautista.
We have the wrong name apparently here on our sheet, but sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
The ALJ satisfied his heightened duty to develop the record in this case, both with respect to the medical evidence and the hearing. The burden is on Mr. Nelms to show that he was prejudiced by a significant omission, and in this case, he has failed to do so.
Oh, he's got that 100 pages of material.
The 100 pages...
It really bears on this orthopedic problem, doesn't it, Ms. Bautista?
The additional medical records that Mr. Nelms has submitted to the district court and to this court is not material. It's cumulative, and it's unlikely that it would have changed the ALJ's decision that Mr. Nelms had the residual functional capacity to perform light work.
Well, these orthopedic problems are sufficient that methadone is prescribed for it. That's pretty severe, isn't it? And that would be different than the record that the ALJ had.
Yet it was consistent with Dr. Bosovich's statement, which was provided in April of 2005, only 2 months before the hearing. Dr. Bosovich was Mr. Nelms' primary care physician since at least February of 2004, if not earlier. And Mr. Bosovich, as his primary care physician, would presumably know Mr. Nelms' longitudinal history and would have had access to those very records. And he indicated in that statement that Mr. Nelms had only mild lumbar spinal stenosis and chronic back pain and that it was controlled with medications.
The record doesn't affirmatively show, though, that the attending internist, in fact, had those records.
As opposing counsel indicated, the record is silent on that, but as Mr. Nelms' primary care physician, we would presume that his primary care physician would know his longitudinal
history.
Help
me out, refresh my recollection. How did these records get into the appellate record here?
Mr. Nelms has submitted them to the court, and it was never before the ALJ or the appeals counsel. And in any case, because this evidence is not material and consistent with Dr. Bozovich's statement, it does not show any significant omission that resulted in prejudice. And in addition, it doesn't meet the criteria for a remand under Sentence 6 of Section 405G, which is the only method for bringing such evidence before this court. Because it's not material, it has no bearing. It would not have changed the ALJ's decision, and it should not be considered. In particular, it's consistent with Dr. Bozovich's statement that not only Mr. Nelms' back condition, but also his heart and asthma conditions were stable, controlled with medications. And it's also consistent with Mr. Nelms' testimony at the hearing that his doctors, including his back doctor, told him that surgery was not necessary and that he should just exercise.
Are you at all contesting or considering those 100 pages of record?
Contesting? In what way, Your Honor?
In the sense that are they a part of the record? Can we consider them?
Our position is that the court should not consider it, and it should be considered only for purposes of whether a remand is appropriate under Sentence 6. But in this case, Mr. Nelms has not requested such a remand, and in any case, he doesn't meet the criteria because, as I indicated, the evidence is not material. But our position is that even if the court does consider this evidence, it still doesn't show that the ALJ failed to develop the record because there was no significant omission and therefore no prejudice.
Mr. Bautista, can I bring up one matter with respect to the hearing itself?
Sure.
The advice that was given by the ALJ to the applicant with respect to having counsel represent him at the hearing, is that advice required by regulation of the department?
I'm not sure if it's required by regulation. I believe that it is required under the agency's policy as well as by case law, but I'm not quite sure if it's required under the regulations.
And is there any particular form or formulation of that evidence that is required?
It can...
Of that advice, I'm sorry.
The advice...
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure, Your Honor. I believe that definitely verbally at the hearing is acceptable. I'm not quite sure if written is acceptable. I know that a valid waiver may be made either orally at the hearing or in writing.
Is it notice given in writing as well about the right to counsel?
Yes. the notice is given in writing as well.
To the applicant.
Yes, it is. It is on a routine basis. But in any event, as opposing counsel indicated, there's no issue of a valid waiver of counsel. They concede
well,
that.
Here's my problem. It seems to me that the advice that was given, that, well, you know, you can have a lawyer here and, you know, the higher-ups think it's a good idea to, you know, you let you have one so someone around to hold your hand, but, you know, I really have the obligation, this is the ALJ speaking, I really have the obligation myself to develop the record on your behalf. So, you know, you can have a lawyer if you want it, but, you know, I want you to know what my obligation is, too. Doesn't that have the effect of lulling the applicant into a sense of complacency about whether he really needs a lawyer or not?
Well, there's no issue in this case of a mental impairment. Mr. Nelms appeared to fully understand the ALJ statements. He was given in writing as well as verbally by the ALJ his right to have an attorney. I do not believe that what the ALJ stated was incorrect or biased.
No doubt that he had a right. He understood he had a right to a lawyer, but you know, the ALJ in effect said, look, pal, I'll take care of you too. Don't worry about it.
The ALJ did not, I don't believe that the ALJ said that he would take care of him. He stated that that he was okay either way. He gave Mr. Nelms the choice. He said, if you want to go ahead with an attorney, I'm okay with that. If you don't want to go ahead with an attorney, I'm okay with that. And he gave Mr. Nelms the choice, and Mr. Nelms stated at least two times that he wanted to proceed because he needed help. And he validly, knowingly, intelligently turned down the ALJ's offer to postpone the hearing so that he could obtain an attorney. And again, this is not an issue that Mr. Nelms has raised in this case. Another point that I want to point out is that it's well established in case law as well as in the regulations that Mr. Nelms carries the burden to provide medical evidence to prove his claim, even a pro se litigant. As this court recently noted in Johnson versus Barnhart, even a pro se litigant bears some responsibility for making a record. And Mr. Nelms' contention that the ALJ statements at the hearing lulled him into a sense of security and shifted the burden from him to the ALJ is groundless and is not supported by any legal authority. The cases that Mr. Nelms relies on, Sears and Thompson, are distinguishable because both of these cases involve plaintiffs who had mental impairments. And as I indicated, there's no issue of mental impairments in this case. Mr. Nelms was advised by a letter from the agency that he could review the file and provide additional evidence. And Mr. Nelms understood that letter as shown by his actions. And he informed the hearing office that he would arrive to review the file, and he brought additional evidence to the hearing, most significantly that statement from Dr. Bozovic. One final point I just want to make regarding the environmental limitations. The ALJ reasonably concluded that Mr. Nelms had no significant environmental limitations. As shown by the record, Mr. Nelms' asthma and cardiac conditions were well controlled with medications, and there's no support for Mr. Nelms' testimony that his symptoms were triggered by hot and cold weather and tree pollen. And in fact, Dr. Collier stated, gave in his opinion that there were no limitations with respect to heat and cold. In addition, Mr. Nelm stated that he had asthma for 20 to 30 years, and yet this never prevented him from working at various jobs during that time, including working at a steel mill, in a freezer at a meatpacking plant, at doing factory work, and so on and so on. And many of these jobs involved temperature extremes and respiratory irritants. I see that my time is up, but I would just like to make one final point. Regarding the Warmoth case, I would like to distinguish this case from the Warmoth case. Dr. Collier stated in his opinion that Mr. Nelms needed to avoid only concentrated exposure to respiratory irritants such as dust and fumes. In the Warmoth case, where the court decided that it did fall between very little and and excessive, those doctors, all of the medical opinions in that record stated that that plaintiff needed to work in an environment free of respiratory irritants. In this case, there's no such opinion, and the only opinion stated that he needed to avoid only concentrated exposure, which does not fall between, but actually falls at slight or very little. So in conclusion, the ALJ fully developed the record, and his decision is supported by substantial evidence. Therefore, we respectfully request that this court affirm the commissioner's decision. Thank you.
Johnson.
Your Honor, just a few points on rebuttal. First, we didn't argue that this came under a sentence 6 remand, as we believe under 14 U.S.C. 405G this would fall under a sentence 4 remand. This additional medical evidence was never new. It accrued the 2 years prior to Mr. Nelms' hearing. If it had occurred after Mr. Nelms' hearing and it was then material and we had submitted it after that point, then it would fall under the sentence 6 rubric. But because it was never new, it would fall under sentence 4.
Was he represented at the Appeals Council?
At the Appeals Council? I believe so. I believe it was the same attorney who wrote the district court brief.
But the Appeals Council was never told about this problem.
Unfortunately, I don't have a good answer for that. It would have been ideal. However, for whatever reason, this additional evidence was revealed to come out during the district court brief, and that's why it was submitted at that time.
Doesn't that constitute a waiver?
Isn't it what?
A waiver.
A waiver?
Yeah, you didn't bring it up.
Well, no, Your Honor, because actually we did. The district court brief did. The counsel at that time did argue that the ALJ failed to fully and fairly develop the record, and that's where we are submitting these records to this court, not for you to analyze them and determine if Mr. Nelms was disabled, but just to show you that there was material evidence out there that could significantly change the ALJ's decision in this case because of those orthopedic conditions. In this case, opposing counsel argues that Dr. Bosovich's four-line opinion somehow makes up for that two-year evidentiary gap with 100 additional pages. However, the ALJ is free to recontact Dr. Bosovich at the remand and ask him why he gave that opinion when his own medical evidence gives a contrary opinion. And additionally, just because Mr. Nelms was not recommended for surgery does not mean that his orthopedic conditions were not severe. I see that my time is up. Your Honors, thank you. We respectfully request that this court remand Mr. Nelms' hearing based on the ALJ's failure to fully fairly develop the record and his failure to include environmental limitations into his residual functional capacity assessment. Thank you.
Okay, thank you to both counsel. This case is taken under advisement. We proceed to